Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to another interview on the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my scholarship and background at rajbalkaran.com. But more importantly, I have the pleasure of speaking today with Dr. Nathan McGovern. He is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Nathan, it's a pleasure to have you on the channel today.
Thank you for having me, Raj.
It's quite the book we're looking at today. As you can see from the link, it's entitled The Snake and the Mongoose, The Emergence of Identity in Early Indian Religion. Now, while I would love to jump into this idea of the snake and the mongoose, maybe say a little bit about your background for our listeners.
My background? Well, I got my PhD at University of California, Santa Barbara, where I did the dissertation work that became this book. Background beyond that, I don't know, I grew up in Memphis. I went to college at Franklin and Marshall College, small liberal arts college in Pennsylvania. Then I went to grad school and then went back to teach at F&M and then had a series of jobs while I was working my way through the job market before I ended up at UW-Whitewater, where I am today.
So our listeners may or may not realize, but it is a very tight job market in our times. So
yes,
no small feat. Employers at the academy are spoiled in terms of the candidates they have. So it's
a buyer's market. Yeah.
Definitely. Remind me again when you finished the PhD.
I believe officially it finished in 2013.
Got it. So I can relate insofar as I finished, I defended in 2015.
Okay.
And I also had so the book that came out this year was also the dissertation turned into a book. So,
congratulations to you too.
Oh, thank you. You know what, actually, at some point, Marshall, who runs the New Books Network, he suggested that I should flip roles and have someone interview me one day for my book. Anyhow, The Snake and the Mongoose. I don't know where to start. It's such a rich book, and it's such a paradigm shifting book potentially for most of our colleagues that it's almost worth unpacking what you don't argue, what you don't write about. so that folks can understand what it is that's revolutionary about the book. So The Snake and the Mongoose. So tell us about that title, perhaps, first of all.
Yeah, I came up with that title during my long job search. I was in Germany that year doing a postdoc on an unrelated topic. And I think I was putting together the book proposal for the publisher and was working on a chapter and realized that this famous passage from the Indian grammarian Patanjali that I had read about way back when I was an undergrad, didn't actually exist. So the passage in question that I had read about in several sources supposedly was that Patanjali says that the relationship between a Brahmin and a Shramana, or an ascetic, is like that between the snake and a mongoose. And so when I was looking at Patanjali, I realized he doesn't actually say that. he does use the example of the Brahman and the Shramana, but he never says anything about a snake and a mongoose, not at least at that point in his grammar. And this kind of struck me because, I'd seen it, several scholarly and sort of pedagogical sources, this supposed passage trotted out to show that, the Shramana movements were intrinsically opposed to the Brahmins. And this is supposed to like explain the origins of Indian religions, that there was this great conflict between two major religious groups in ancient India. And the imagery is very vivid, right, of a snake and a mongoose. You can imagine, the way they fight with each other and so forth. And then I realized that this was not actually the case. And I thought this needs to be the image for my book, because this is emblematic of exactly the model of Indian religions that I'm criticizing. This model that that the major Indian religions of Buddhism, Jainism, and Hinduism arose out of a major conflict between the Shramanas and the Brahmins.
So maybe it's an incredible image, and I think obviously quite apt for the argument you're making. Which is really that this is a trope, sort of. This is a misconception that the Shramanas and the Brahmanas, whomever they were, if ever they were, weren't at odds in this manner. So let me sort of maybe share very, very quickly, 30,000-foot view, how we, or at least I, generally teach, say, intro Hinduism. And then that might be a good... that may be good context for our listeners in terms of what's different about this book. Now, I have this idea that I call the Dharmic double helix, in that there are these two strands of Dharma. I may be entirely educated during this interview, and I may not teach it this way anymore. We'll see. However, I tend to teach Hinduism in terms of this entity with these two impulses that are quite different but woven in together. And the first impulse is what I call Vedic religion, in terms of fire sacrifice, caste system, progeny, world affirmation. And this other impulse I consider as being folded back in from the Shramana tradition, the tradition of renouncers who may or may not be forest dwellers, who sort of subscribe to other philosophical notions and pursue metaphysical realities. And they seek out a teacher, and sort of the holy man, the sadhu sort of figure that becomes the face of Hinduism, even in modern times. Right. And how I think of it is that there is this other religious impulse in the Shramana movement that eventually coalesces into what we call Hinduism, right? Creating this double helix, and alternatively what we call now Jainism and Buddhism. But at the time of this religious movement, the distinctions between Jainism and Buddhism and Hinduism are tenuous at best, if existent. Now, what would you say about teaching Hinduism this way?
Yeah, I don't think that's a completely full model at all. Certainly, many scholars have seen there to be a tension either in Hinduism specifically or in Indian religions as a whole between those two general impulses. I think where questions arise is, how exactly did those two strands come about? And is it sufficient to sort of attribute them to a Brahmanical tradition and a Shramanic tradition, which I think is the way you characterized it? And I think depending on your purposes, it either may be sufficient or maybe not sufficient. I mean, I think if you're talking about classical Hinduism or the Middle Ages in India, or anything sufficiently far removed from the time period that I'm talking about, which is in ancient India. That sort of a model, I think, is not terribly problematic. Because just in terms of scale, you're sort of removed from the issue of how the strands came about. But if we're talking about ancient India, that's where I sort of critique that model, at least insofar as the model supposes that there's a hard and fast distinction between the Brahmanical and the Sharmanic traditions. I mean, the way I usually characterize the model that I'm criticizing is one in which Shramanism arose principally in antagonism or opposition to Brahmanism, and that I think is a flawed model. That's what I'm criticizing, the idea that there's something fundamentally separate about those two strands. I mean, it's well known that these two strands become interwoven in Hinduism itself, and I guess I would argue that they were always interwoven in some sense.
So really, the snake and the mongoose is really proposing an entirely new methodology for understanding ancient India and understanding these strands of what we now, as you would say, anachronistically think of as Brahmanism versus Buddhism versus Jainism. So maybe tell us the main takeaway, the main theme in terms of what you're proposing versus the accepted scholarly view.
Sure. So my argument is that whereas typically it's been argued, as I said, that Buddhism, Hinduism, and Jainism arose out of a conflict, an intrinsic opposition between Brahmanism and the Sharamana movements. I argue that, in fact, there was a conflict in ancient India, but the conflict was not between a Sharamana movement and a Brahmin movement that were somehow intrinsically separate, but rather among different religious groups who were contesting the category Brahmin. So what's the difference then? The difference is whether we see Shramana and Brahmin as intrinsically separate or not. And what I argue is that we shouldn't see them that way. That most groups in ancient India were engaging in some sort of Shramana activity, that is, some sort of renunciate activity that involved celibacy. And all of them, I argue, were claiming to be Brahmins. And I think with some justification. In other words, that you can trace their practices, their beliefs, you know, in each case, back to earlier Vedic texts. And in particular, the practice of brahmacharya, so brahmacharya, the practice of renunciate celibacy, that this was claimed to be a way to become a Brahmin, in fact. And so on that basis, there was some justification for different groups, you know, claiming to be Brahmins through their Shramana activities. And then there were, on the other hand, there was one group or one set of groups that were reactionary in this respect, and they ended up arrogating the category Brahmin to themselves on a different basis, not on the basis of celibate renunciation, but actually on the basis of birth. And they did so because they were champions of householdership.
So Nathan, would you say then, so two questions I have. One, mm-hmm. I have many, but I have two that I'll ask. For the sake of our audience, would you say that, so what you're saying is that this the religious practice of celibacy of brahmacharya, mm-hmm. that it, in your view, stems from even within Vedic religion?
Yes, I think that there's certainly, brahmacharya seems to have a very old basis for being interpreted as celibacy, and I think that there are definitely, and this is something that I explore in my book, that there is at least precedent for general renunciant practices in the Vedas. I don't think I'm particularly unique in saying that. Go ahead.
And so
What would you say about the tension between the householder and the ascetic in terms of your argument?
Yeah, so many scholars have talked about this tension. I mean, we talk about like the inner conflict of tradition, for example. In my argument, that tension is front and center in explaining how, as I put it, how the snake and the mongoose came about, but by which I mean how the opposition between the Shramana and the Brahmin came about. In other words, as these different quote-unquote Brahmanical groups, that is groups that were claiming to be Brahmins, were debating the role that celibacy and general renunciatory practices should play, there became a sort of dividing line between those who were committed to those practices and those who were opposed to them. And as I was saying earlier, those who were opposed to them, who I identify with the authors of the Dharma Sutras, they basically made the argument that you have to produce children, and therefore the householder life is the only acceptable lifestyle. And in the process, they wanted to separate, I argue, Brahminhood from celibacy, because they saw celibacy as being so problematic. And one of the ways they did that was by formalizing the Varna system. And in the Varna system, of course, Brahminhood is conferred on the basis of birth, not on the basis of anything else. And thus by arrogating that title to themselves, eventually other groups ended up sort of ceding the title, and thus there was this bifurcation between Brahmins and Shramanas.
And so the Shramana movement, the impulse to give up caste or the Vedic sacrificial religion, mm-hmm. or progeny, mm-hmm. You do view that as a separate impulse from the core Vedic religion, correct? Or do you actually view that as perhaps an evolution?
This image I use in the book to express what I imagine going on here, and I admit that at this point I'm getting a little bit speculative, but in the concluding chapter, what I imagine in, say, around the 5th century BCE, which would have been probably when the Buddha and Mahavira lived, that there was an expansive set of loosely defined Brahmin groups, by which I mean groups that claim to be Brahmins. And some of them were more, shall we say, traditional. Some were more avant-garde. I take the groups that became the Jains and the Buddhists to be those on the avant-garde. They were taking ideas that were, say, found in the late Vedas and the Upanishads, ideas about rebirth, to their logical extreme and sort of running with it. And I don't see it actually so much as being a matter of necessarily deliberately abandoning older practices. It's just not really being interested in them anymore. I mean, I think in some cases they were deliberately abandoned, but in other cases they just had sort of become, out of fashion, or out of, you know, they just were not really relevant anymore. And so they just, like I said, they were on the avant-garde, so they took ideas and started running with them. I see, more traditional groups as being kind of like the forest-dwelling ascetic groups. I think that these were groups that were, going along with whatever sort of changes happened to be going on in the religious landscape, but not really pushing things like the avant-garde was. And then on the other extreme were the reactionary groups. And these are the groups that were actually, I would argue, innovative, as reactionaries are, innovative in creating, although in their mind, defending an old order that probably to a certain certain extent only existed in their minds.
So certainly it makes sense that what we call now the Jain and Buddhist movements would have been the more avant-garde, as you say, in terms of pushing, pushing the envelope of this religious frontier.
Right.
Now, within this milieu, not those who are more avant-garde, but maybe those who would be more conservative, but yet within this ideology of moksha, karma, samsara. So this is something I'd like to ask you about. And most non-scholars of Hinduism, and particularly practitioners, don't realize that the very idea of karmic theory, of rebirth, of salvation, of moksha, of liberation, that this ideology enters the fore in the late Upanishadic period, centuries leading up to or contemporaneous with the rise of Buddhism or Buddhist thought.
Right.
Now, this religious thrust, would you see this as an evolute of Vedic religion? And of course, for our listeners, obviously not for your sake, I'd say that Vedic religion is an analog to, say, ancient Greek or Roman religion, where you have a pantheon of deities,
right,
pleased through sacrifice, and then you want prosperity on earth and you want heaven, and it's a fundamentally different apparatus. So then how would you square the fact that even those who aren't so avant-garde, who adopt this ideology, still perhaps radically undercut Vedic religion?
I see. I do agree that this is something that was an evolute of Vedic religion, but something that was, you know, fundamentally new compared to, say, the oldest strands of Vedic religion. In other words, the idea of karma and rebirth and so forth, that these were the result of speculations that really didn't come to a head until the Upanishadic period. It seems that this avant-garde represented by the Jains and Buddhists, that they really ran with those ideas. And ultimately, even though I think there was a backlash against those movements, you know, from more reactionary sort of elements, nevertheless, they ended up becoming standard for Indian religions in general. The way I express this in the book is that even though, say, what I call the Neo-Brahman, the proponents of Neo-Brahmanism, that is, the authors of the Dharma Sutras, were successful in arrogating the title Brahman to themselves, they were not successful at staving off renunciatory values or the worldview that accompanies them, which is the worldview of karma and rebirth. You can see that, especially in terms of the renunciatory values in the laws of Manu, where the ashrama system gets changed from a series of four options, which in the Dharma Sutras are all pretty much rejected except for the householder, to instead a series of four stages of life. Which I'm not the first to say this, Oliva was the one who did the classic study on this, was a way of accommodating renunciatory lifestyles into a, you know, Hindu dharmic framework. Basically the idea being, yes, you can do celibacy and you can do renunciation, but have your babies first. So they're relegated to old age. And so then there's this progression that leads to the lifestyles in which you would eventually pursue moksha. It is a bit of an irony, I guess, if you could think of it that way, that there was a development of new ideas within the tradition. They sort of end up going in their own direction and being rejected by the more conservative elements of the tradition, but then they ended up becoming part of the tradition anyway.
Yeah, it's this walking contradiction where you can't really dispense with the social ideology of householding, and you can't dispense with the spiritual supremacy of sort of this stoic foregoing of children, of pleasure, and this is the walking contradiction. This is I do it synchronically, not diachronically, but this is why I feel the epics and the Puranas, the mythological texts, are replete with kings, you know, if the king is the glorified householder and end up in exile talking to forest-dwelling ascetics, and the king in forest exile, I think, is a mythological encapsulation of exactly what you're talking about. So fascinating. There's so much here. So tell us about, because it's sort of lodged in a specific history, and our listeners may or may not know particularly what the Dharma Shastras do, but tell us about Neo-Brahmanism. What do you mean when you refer to the Neo-Brahmins?
So Neo-Brahmanism, it is my term, but it's not originally my idea. So I got the idea from Johannes Bronckhorst, another scholar of early India. He calls it the New Brahmanism. I just found it more convenient to switch the terminology to Neo-Brahmanism, but it's the same idea. What he calls the New Brahmanism is a sort of a revamped Brahmanism in the light of the rise of Buddhism and other Shramana religions that sought to remake it in very remake itself in very specific ways, so as to successfully compete for patronage and so forth. And he argues in he has several books that are related to this, but the main one I believe would be Buddhism in the Shadow of Brahmanism, is that that certain things that we take for granted about Brahmanism or Hinduism were actually adopted in this period, that is in the period in the centuries after, say, the reign of the Mauryas, who, you know, especially under Ashoka, were known for patronizing Sharamana groups. So this involves, among other things, a sort of reimagining of the past in a particular Brahmanical image, and a particular valorization of the Varna system, the use of Sanskrit, the supremacy of Brahmins, and so forth.
So this would be, in your view, primarily anachronistic, in that this is sort of a projection. The idea that Brahmanism predates Buddhism is sort of just assumed by scholarship, but right, is interrogated by your work.
Yeah, I have a discussion of this in the introduction. In a sense, yeah, I do critique the idea that Brahmanism precedes Buddhism. Now, you could read that in different ways. I mean, there's a sort of naive way where you could read that and say, well, you know, Nathan McGovern, you're completely wrong. That's ridiculous. Because, of course, there were Brahmins before there were Buddhists. So in that sort of just very literal sense, Brahmanism does precede Buddhism. What I critique is the idea that just because there were Brahmins before there were Buddhists, therefore Brahmanism as an ideology metahistorically precedes Buddhism. And that's what I critique because I think that the very fact that there were Brahmins before Buddhists can be used to leap to the conclusion that therefore whatever we imagine Brahmanism to be, that somehow precedes Buddhism. And that is what I see as problematic. And I don't think that, you know, that I'm being completely innovative here. I think that there have been several scholars, including Bronckhorst, others like Olivelle, who have shown that a lot of the things that we associate with Brahmanism, a lot of the texts that we associate with Brahmanism, in fact, postdate Buddhism. And so this has actually been an exciting time for scholarship, realizing the extent to which a lot of the things that we take for granted about, you know, Brahmanical ideology, that they're actually a bit later than we once imagined.
So for the sake of our listeners, what are some of the things that are taken for granted in the scholarship about Brahmanical ideology of this period?
Certain key components would be like the ashrama system, which in fact, I mean, as Olivelle showed, developed over several centuries, first showed up in the Dharma Sutras, which were probably not written until about the time of Buddhism and then shortly thereafter. And then was changed, as I described, in the Laws of Manu, probably in the early centuries CE, rather. The Varna system, which I argue in my book, has an antiquity of sorts, but I think is a formalized system in which you actually say, okay, there are four classes that are named, and they are subsumed under the category Varna, and they're explicitly said to be ranked according to birth, or be determined by birth. That I think is also something that first, you know, in a very explicit sense shows up in the Dharma Sutras. So around the time of Buddhism or shortly thereafter. And also the use of Sanskrit. This has been shown by Pollock and others to have, although having a sort of continuous pedigree, that the widespread use of Sanskrit postdates Buddhism. And then last of all, something that was important to the new Brahmanism or neo-Brahmanism is an emphasis on householdership. Although that, of course, is something that was sort of negotiated over the course of the tradition later on, such that there became a continual tension between householder values and renunciant values.
So maybe take us into a couple of the chapters of your book. You start off with some synchronic work, and then you do some diachronic work. Yeah. And maybe if we can in as accessible a manner as we can present some of the evidence that you present for this thesis.
Sure. So you just want me to go through the chapters?
Maybe first mention a couple of the textual accounts and the synchronic sources, synchronic methodologies you used, and then maybe we can go from there.
Right. After the introduction, which is the themes we've just been talking about, and then chapter two, Snake of the Mongoose of the Horizon of Indian History, I just talk mainly about certain historical issues about dating and so forth. Chapter three, Taming the Snake and the Mongoose of Indian History, that's a more synchronic kind of study in which basically I'm just trying to demonstrate that in the evidence that we have, even after the point where I think that there started to be because the issue is that it's difficult to date texts. And so I admit that, and I say, all scholars of ancient India sort of are like pulling their hair out trying to figure out how to date texts, and it's impossible to do with any, accuracy, down to the decade or even the century in many cases. So let's just ask, even for texts that may be coming after the time when Shramanas and Brahmins were considered somewhat separate, can we find any evidence of the categories being treated as not oppositional? And what I show is that, in fact, you can find lots of evidence of this and what I mainly look at is the Pali Canon, so the scriptures, the early scriptures of Buddhism, and in the edicts of the Emperor Ashoka, and show that usually when the categories Brahman and Shraman, so this is sort of a set phrase, Shramanas and Brahmins, this is found in frequently in the Pali Canon and in the edicts of Ashoka, not used usually in an oppositional sense. And that might be even after there was sort of a sense that maybe these are separate groups, but actually the way that they're used is not oppositional. They're usually used as a single unit. In other words, Shramanas and Brahmins sort of breathlessly, like this is a single category of religious practitioners. Then chapters four and five, I sort of present the case, which I've already been doing earlier in this interview, that we can understand all the groups of ancient India as Brahmins, just in their own sense. So chapter four, I talk about the Brahmin as a celibate renunciant. That's where I present the argument that, in fact, early Jains and early Buddhists claim to be Brahmins, and that we can take them at their word. Usually the way this has been interpreted is that they're just doing so as a polemic. In other words, this is usually called the trope of the true Brahmin, that Buddhists would say, the Buddha was a Brahmin, or enlightened folk are Brahmins, to sort of denigrate, socially those who are Brahmins. And I argue that although that does seem to have become the case eventually, I think early on they just were calling themselves Brahmins because they thought that they were Brahmins. And I make the argument that there is precedent for that in the Vedic texts. Chapter five, the Brahmin is the head of the household. That's where I look closely at the Apastamba Dharma Sutra, which I argue holds the key for understanding how the more reactionary forces of this time arrogated the category Brahman to themselves. In other words, what I argue is that in this Dharma Sutra, what they're trying to accomplish is a separation of the category Brahman from celibate renunciation, and instead tying it to birth. Chapter 6, this is where I get to be more diachronic. And this has to do with an issue of interpretation, mainly in the early Buddhist scriptures. I try to show that the passages I've been looking at earlier, in which the ideal Buddhist person is called a Brahman, is in which I argue that is meant somewhat literally, that they didn't just mean that as a polemic. I try to show that over time this changed, and you can show that by looking at successive layers of early commentary and see that whereas originally passages would just say, you know, the person who is enlightened I call a Brahman or something along those lines, then like a story will be added to say like, oh, the Buddha saw some, you know, Brahman by birth who was making outrageous claims, and then he uttered this verse, you know, thus making it into a polemic, a contrast between the Buddha Brahman and the Brahman by birth. And then last of all, in chapter 7, losing an argument by focusing on being right, I also look at some Buddhist texts, which I call encounter dialogues. These are texts in which the Buddha encounters a Brahman by birth, that is, a representative of what I would call neo-Brahmanism, somebody who claims that, you know, there is a Varna system, that Brahmins are determined by birth, that Brahmins are superior to all other classes, and usually who also claim that the householder lifestyle is best, and has some sort of debate with them. I argue that these texts actually were indicative of how the neo-Brahmanical movement was successful in arrogating the category to themselves, because these texts actually basically ended up giving sort of free press to them, which was not reciprocated. You don't have, you know, like in the Dharma Sutras, texts about encounters with Buddhist monks and debates with them, right? And on the other hand, in a narrative fashion, it sets up just in terms of the narrative, an opposition between one person who identifies only as a Brahmin and another person who is defending the Shramana movement and therefore is automatically sort of cast as a Shramana other. And so I argue that these narratives serve to reinforce the sense that Brahman and Shramana were separate, even though that was not the point that they were trying to make. The point they were trying to make was actually that, you know, essentially that Shramanas are Brahmins, but by their very narrative structure, they reinforce the opposite person's side.
Mm. So I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to present a teeny bit of context first, so that our listeners can understand what's at stake here. So we consider generally scholars of Indian religion, scholars and teachers of Indian religion, consider the Jains and the Buddhists as revolutionary insofar as they dispense with the Vedic revelation, the Sanskrit language eventually, caste. Caste is huge. So this may be well internalized by folks like you and I, but the idea is that, well, Brahmanical Hinduism, a Brahmana is the member of the highest echelon of the caste system, whose role it is to preserve knowledge and perform priestly ritual duties. And so is what you're saying then that these early Buddhists that consider themselves Brahmins, would you say that they retain their caste, or would you say that distinction itself doesn't apply looking back?
I lean to the second of what you said, that the distinction doesn't apply. The issue of caste, Raj, is so complicated.
Tell me about it.
yeah. I mean, for one thing, there's the distinction between cast per se, which is extremely complicated, and class, class being the usually considered the more proper translation of Varna. So there are four classical Varnas or classes, and then the caste systems of India are usually much more complicated and related to Varna in a very complicated and often contested way. So the question would be, you know, in the period that I'm talking about, to what extent is caste operative and affected by Buddhism or becoming a Buddhist or so forth? That's something that I really deal with directly in my book, which, yeah, I don't deal with caste directly, and I don't feel like I'm enough of an expert on the issue of the history of caste to really comment in a lot of detail about it, except to say that I think that the certain aspects of the antiquity of, say, a rigid caste system are sometimes exaggerated. Certainly in the Vinaya, which is a branch of the early Buddhist scriptures that deals with monastic discipline, there are rules that seem to indicate that something like caste was a social reality at the time that those texts were composed, because there are rules basically preventing discrimination on the basis of caste. For in other words, you're not supposed to respect those distinctions when somebody has been ordained into the Sangha. I don't find that to be because what I study in my book is more the sutta literature, so the narrative literature of the Buddhist scriptures, which is a little bit earlier. I don't find the same questions about caste to be as pervasive a theme there. I find more often the issue of the Varna system, which does show up frequently in the what I call encounter dialogues. In other words, suttas in which the Buddha encounters a proponent of Neo-Brahmanism and debates with him, and they'll debate the validity of the Varna system, and basically, you know, what the Buddha will say in every case is that, like, what are you talking about? This Varna system that you claim is operative has no relationship to social reality. So caste, however, does seem to have become a concern for Buddhists a little bit later on in the, I don't know what to say, does it show up at all in the suttas? It's not coming to my mind right away, but certainly it does show up in the Vinaya.
So these early Buddhists who would have self-identified as Brahmanas, they wouldn't necessarily be upholding the same kind of Varna system that we think of as in operation now.
You mean at the time that the Buddhist suttas were written?
The correct. Those Buddhists of the Neo-Brahmanism era that you're talking about, those Buddhists who identified as Brahmanas, they wouldn't necessarily be upholding sort of the Varna system that we think of now in terms of Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, etc.
So you mean if a Brahmin converted to Buddhism?
Yes. So the Buddhists, the Buddhists that identified as Brahmins.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Period, then if they're identifying as Brahmins,
right.
Just to tease this out a bit, right?
Sure.
The Buddhists.
So the Buddhist conception of I understand what you're saying now. This is part of why the top of my book is difficult to discuss, because the word Brahmin becomes very confusing after a while. So the early Buddhists, who were, insofar as they were claiming to be Brahmins, they certainly were not advocating the Varna system at all. Yeah, they were not advocating the Varna system at all. They were, and it seems that the Jains were doing exactly the same thing, claiming Brahminhood not on the basis of birth, but on the basis of undergoing brahmacharya. And there's a fairly, well, there are a few passages from Vedic texts that I refer to in the book in which there seems to be some indication of an older conception of a person becoming a Brahmin. And I think that this is what that they were, this is the strand of the tradition that they were picking up on, that through their practice, they created Brahmins, right? And their practice, of course, was one of celibate renunciation. So yeah, it had nothing to do with birth. They were not interested in the Varna system.
Right. So the
The Buddhists ridiculed the Varna system. Exactly. So when I say ridiculed, I don't mean that they criticized it in the sense that, like, say, Americans today criticize racism or something like that. I mean, they ridicule it as like, this has nothing to do with reality, that kind of ridicule.
Right. And this is what I'm teasing out. So the early Buddhists of that era, they would identify as being Brahmanas, not in the sense of what we think of today in terms this Vedic social institution.
Right.
But in the sense of the Brahmana is the learned one, the wise one.
Right, exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Which is fascinating, right? It's absolutely fascinating to take a word that is a keystone to what we would call now is maybe the caste system. And this word is sort of either, one could even say there's a renovation in play here. Yeah, so it's like the true Brahmana, the true Brahmin isn't someone who was born to certain parents. There's somebody who understands the world, understands reality, understands truth. Right. And that could very well be a follower of the Buddha, for example.
Right.
So this is, I'm asking these questions to tease it out because in sort of presenting the opposite view of what your book is arguing, it really shows the importance or the importance in the sense of the contrast. It shows how novel or against the grain of our understanding your argument is. So this has been fascinating. I think we've taken enough of your time for one day. I do want to ask before we close, what are you working on now? What's the next project?
Sure. I'm working on several things, but in terms of something that's fairly different and a major project that I've been working on for a few years now, actually, that goes beyond the work that's in this book. This is actually something not in South Asia, it's in Southeast Asia. I've been studying the royal court Brahmins of Thailand, which is really interesting to me because Thailand is a Buddhist country. And actually, this is related to what got me interested in the topic that I ended up doing for this book, because many years ago, when I first got to grad school, I was going to Thailand, and I went there because it was Buddhist. I wanted to, I was studying Buddhism. I wanted to see a living Buddhist culture. And I was amazed at how much quote unquote Hindu stuff I kept seeing everywhere, Hindu gods that were worshipped or had shrines to them, Hindu imagery and Thai art, including a vast mural of the Ramakien, which is the Thai version of the Ramayana, around the most important Buddhist temple in Bangkok, Wat Pa Kiao, the temple of the Emerald Buddha, and these Brahmins who work for the Thai king. So there are currently 16 of them. They have a very small temple right down the street from City Hall in Bangkok. And they have outside of that temple a giant swing, which anybody who's been to Bangkok has probably seen or heard of, that they used to use in their rituals, although they don't use it anymore. And what's fascinating about these Brahmins is that they are now completely acculturated Thai people. But they were originally Brahmins from India who migrated probably from Tamil Nadu several hundred years ago. They perform rituals on behalf of the palace, including the consecration ritual for a new king, which they're supposed to do, I believe, in May for King Rama the 10th, the current king. His father passed away a couple years ago. But they do an annual ritual called the Triempawai Tripawai, which involves the recitation of Tamil Bhakti hymns. And when I found this out, I was just like completely flabbergasted by this and fascinated by it. So this is sort of an ongoing project of mine. I've published a little bit about it, but I'm hoping to publish more sort of a history of these Brahmins, how they ended up in Thailand, and what role they play in Thai religion, which, as I said, is overwhelmingly Buddhist.
It's fascinating. I was in Bangkok very briefly in 2005. Every 3 years, there's the World Sanskrit Conference. So it was last.
Oh, right, right.
In 2018, it was actually in Vancouver, but before that, in 2015, it was in Bangkok. Yeah. So I had some time. I didn't travel about, but I had some time to soak up the culture in between panels and whatnot. Right. And it was a deeply fascinating culture. You see elements of Hinduism throughout. I believe that at the airport in Bangkok, you have the largest statue of a what one thinks of as a sort of quintessential Indian Hindu myth of the churning of the ocean between the gods and the demons and the gods of the Vedic sky, essentially. It is absolutely fascinating. I feel that. Both the public and students, therefore, of Indian religions, sort of have this caricature of Buddhism as exclusively philosophical and Hinduism as ritualistic and polytheistic. And the truth is that, I mean, they're both, and it's just a rich interplay.
Raj, let me just say that is a complete myth that is based on a projection of anti-Catholic tropes. From the colonial period, basically, in which worked to Hinduism's disfavor. It's just a projection of sort of like battles between Catholicism and Protestantism has nothing to do with reality.
Well, on the ground, it appears that snakes and mongooses can get along just fine, and Buddhists could have identified as Brahmins, and who knows what. So, it has been a pleasure speaking today with Dr. Nathan McGovern, who is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, on his new publication, The Snake and the Mongoose. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Raj. I appreciate it.